Session number 10252.
Mr. Blatch, reel 3.
In the lazarette, I had been looking around, always with a thought in mind as to what best I could do, having come from Doolaglouth, with getting out. Now, it was a vast complex, and I didn't really think that one could get through the wire, although I supposed it was possible, but I hadn't given it a lot of thought. It depended an awful lot on what sort of type of nature people have made of an escape committee or whatever, and what the administrative path was like on our side. The Germans we knew about, but what was happening on our side, I didn't know. So Gordon was a person I asked immediately about what the situation was. His answer to that was quite brief and straight to the point. Well, he said, if you want to consider doing that, then you have to A, get fit first, and B, the quickest way out is on a working party. And I said, working party, what do you mean? He said, yes, Arbeit's Kommando. They go out from here. I said, are those all those scruffy-looking soldiers that come in through the main gate and then come over to here for treatment, with dental and your sort of treatment? He said, that's right. Those are the people. They come in from all types and natures of working parties. They were formed soon after I got here. He was there from Dunkirk. And it works very well for them, he said. Some of the parties are good, some are bad. He said, not many people work very hard anyway. They do, you know, most of them try and carry out whatever sabotage they can, but you have to be very, very careful when you get out there, because if you're caught doing that, then you are liable to be put into a civilian prison and very badly treated indeed. Or shot. If you get trigger-happy guards, they'll shoot you on the job. So I said, well, I'm not really interested so much in the semantic side, but what I'm really interested in is would it be possible, do you think, for me to get somebody looking similar to me and change over? And he said, well, it has been done once before here, but he said it depends what sort of party we're talking about, whether there's a large number, whether they come in at evening and go out in the dark and things like that. Anyway, I won't go into fine detail. It's sufficient to say that this whole thing started boiling up within me, and I thought, well, this certainly is a way to go, and after all, I've got nothing to lose. I don't know anybody here apart from Gordon McRae. I haven't really got into the system yet, and I'd be better off out, and I certainly want to get out. I used to look through the wire in the evening from my bed, and I used to see the lights of Lansdorf Village and the station Annadorf glittering across the snow, and I used to think to myself, because this we're talking about December time, I used to say to myself, I've got to get out of here. And really have. It was a miserable, godsforsaken looking hole with people tied up all over the place. But, of course, that was I to know later that I was going to meet far worse places than that. But however, I still had plenty of energy, and I was going to go that way. We arranged eventually that a working party that was coming in from Dąbrowa, a place on the Polish border. There was a big mine there, a couple of hundred Kriegsgefangenes, that is to say, her prisoners of war worked there and got heavy rations for so doing, because it was very heavy work. They worked 16 hours a day, some of them on the coal face, some of them on the surfaces. They worked 16 hours a day. It was, when I say it was in Poland, on the Polish border, you must remember geographically, which I found out later, that actually it was in Oberschlesia, which was just the German side of the Polish border, and the new border which the Germans had established was called the Generalgouvernement Zone, General Government Zone. And beyond that, to the east, was all Poland proper, according to the Germans. So, the fact that it was where it was, at that stage, played no part in my mental attitude toward it at all. I knew that I had to get to the Baltic ports to get ships. I knew I had to get to Switzerland overland if I wanted to get into a place of safety. I knew I couldn't. I'd have to get out of Switzerland again, because obviously they interned one. But on the other hand, I knew that if I got to a Baltic port, I could get ships going to Sweden and Denmark or whatever, and would probably be home that way. Other people had done it, I'd learned. But first of all, I wanted to see what all this escaping business was about and how best it could be managed. Anyway, again, cutting a long story short, it was over a number of perhaps 6 or 7 weeks. I got stuff together. I was put back into the compound. He kept me there as long as he possibly could, and then called me back in when he thought there was a party that was suitable. It had to be a large party, it had to be many people, so that I'd get somebody vaguely looking like me, and that they had to be wanting treatment so they could stay in 24 hours at least, and allow the changeover to be done in or in the precincts of the lazarette under his direction. This is exactly what happened. Party came in, 50 strong, all needing medical attention from their labours in the coal mine, and one such a man, Heenan, H-W-N-A-N, Private Heenan, commander, he was number two commander in Middle East, originally East Surrey Regiment, I believe. He looked somewhat similar, he had fair hair, and I'd grown a moustache, a bit of a handlebar job, and he had no moustache, so that was simple for me to shave off my moustache if I wished to, and I would then not be noted as what I was anyway. It was something which I didn't grow intentionally. I had it when I came into Germany, but it was something which proved to be rather useful, and in the context of not being quite myself when people looked at me as they did before. The only person that had been keeping an eye on me was a person, an underofficer in the lager, named Kessel, K-E-S-S-E-L, underofficer Kessel, known as Ukrainian Joe. He was a brutal beast, and he used to kick, punch, torment, and shoot to the Russians outside our wire most of the day. And I have seen him actually pistol whip one of our chaps who wouldn't put his string on properly, you know, binding his hand. So he was a rather unsavoury character. For some reason, I let him know that I did understand what he was saying to me, and also made clear that I didn't understand much more, which I did, of course. And therefore he sort of thought, I suppose, that since I was intelligent, as he thought, enough to understand a little German, he would make a particular friend of me, or friend, question mark. But he used to talk to me on time to time. That was great. And he used to very often avoid me doing things I wouldn't have normally done. I had to go, there were fatigues doing this, that or the other. He used to say, Mr. Bletch, perhaps you won't have to do this. I send somebody else. And, of course, being natural, I didn't always want to go with a particularly working party if I had bad legs at the time I had. So I used to accept that much anyway, and, if you like, fraternisation. But I began to learn after a bit that he was looking at me, and he knew me very well, and my moustache and all. And I thought, well, I don't know, Joe Kessel's going to be a problem about this. And I had quite got into the business of what you do, really, when one gets experience, you just disappear into the background. You don't make yourself obvious to anybody. And but when the time came, Heenan came along. He was very much like me. I went over to, McRae called me over to the lazarette again with my legs, which were breaking out a bit again. And I was in there 24 hours, in which time he came in for dentistry. He was in there for, I think, 12 hours turnaround. We went into two toilets, which were divided by a partition. It had all been arranged beforehand. He'd spoken to Heenan, and I'd given him all the dope, and Heenan was quite willing. So he came back into my place in the Air Force camp, and I went as his. Now, I was fortunate in going out because it was dusk, and there was only two guards in charge of the detail, and we went out and nobody knew any different. They just counted the heads and off we went. They were all, the chaps knew what I was doing, of course, and they got round me and clustered around, and I had thick army overcoat on, turned the collar up and all that way. But it was dark in the winter, as I say, and trudging through snow, so that was great. And when I got there, of course, I just dissolved into the background. But there was a 7-hour journey, by the way, by train. But when he got in, he was taken over by McRae himself. Joe Kessel came along near the main gate, I'm told, and didn't know I'd been taken over, so didn't make any bones about this fellow coming in with McRae. He didn't know, he just assumed it was another member from a working party, had been, you know, been treated and then was coming in for a day or so. That was very fortunate, because had he known I'd gone over to the lazarette, he certainly would have asked who the fellow was, or where I was. And they would have said, you know, well, where is he? Because they mean you very well. So that was that situation. I got out onto the camp now. Pipra. Dombrova, a small town on the edge of Katowice, near the Obersilesian Polish General Government area, which the Germans had made the boundary of, was a dull, unprepossessing looking place. There was a steel mills behind it. It was a huge mine, so enormous in fact, the first time I went down to work on the coalface, and there were 150 British soldiers working in the camp, working in the mine, as I've said, 16 hours a day, right through the week. Heavy rations, that's to say you've got far more bread, black bread, far more soup, and it was soup with vegetables and potatoes and things in, and you also got the ration of a Red Cross parcel a week, which came from Lambsdorff, from the camp. They had parcels, but of course, as I've said earlier, explained, the Air Force compounds and the Canadian compounds, since we were tied up for the sins we were reputed to have committed, we had no Red Cross, so this was a great boost to my physical aspects in having to work. But in the same time, it was a situation which led me to consider very closely what I was going to do about escaping, because here we had 16 hours a day. When I went down there, I found that it was an enormous place, so big in fact that as you came off the lift at the bottom of the shaft, one had to go for almost 3/4 of a mile to reach the first coal face, and hard by was a huge grotto carved out of the solid rock, which was used as a church by the Poles. Now all the workers down, civilian workers, were Polish, and the overmen for them, the Steigers as they were called, were Obersilesians, known to the Germans and the Poles as Volksdeutsche, which meant that they were in fact of German persuasion. They in Obersilesia they spoke both Polish and German, but their political affiliation and their every other affiliation was Germany. So those are the people obviously to watch. So the Poles were working, the Obersteigers were Volksdeutsch, and we were set in among them, like scattered like jewels, variously. I went on to the coalface because I learned there, I was pretty fit by this time, I was strong. I'd learned that the Poles that worked on the coalface were really good Poles. Many of them, although they lived in the area of Katowice or Sosnowice, two large steel places nearby, still steel towns, they were very, very Polish, and they used to bring stuff in for the chaps who used to barter and trade with them. Now I felt if they bartered and trade all sorts of food, and they got all sorts of things, guitars, musical instruments, all sorts of things, if they could do this, I felt that there was a chance they might do something a little bit more solidly patriotic. So when I went down, I took my time for a couple of weeks in sorting myself out, and eventually I found a senior Polish worker on the coalface who spoke very good German, and I got to know him very well, and he liked me and I liked him. I used to help him with putting the charges in the coalface and blowing and drilling. Now he explained, he knew exactly what I was up to, we discussed it several times. I had to trust somebody, and he said, well, I won't ever let you down, but I don't know what I can do for you. I asked him for passes, maps, compasses. No, he couldn't do anything of that. But what he could do, he said, he could certainly get me civilian clothes, which he did. And he also pointed out that at the end of one of the long disused mine shafts, there was a disused air shaft going to the surface. And he said, I don't know what condition the wood is, that the wooden rungs of the ladders that lead up to things. Very, very, goes a long, long way, but that might be a possibility. So working on that assumption and having a look at it from time to time, I decided that's the way I was going to go. I had to do a number of things in that context. I had to make sure I went down. When one came up from the mine, so then you went to the bathhouse and you had a bath and a shower and went off, and then you were all congregated in the place near the lift shaft where the postern collected you again. Of course, you couldn't get out of the mine, or at least they didn't think you could. And then you were taken back to the camp, to our own camp, British camp, where we were all housed. my idea was to, on this particular shift, was to go down with civilian clothes under my working clothes. It's going to be very, very hot, because it was very hot down the mine. My boots would have done quite well, because they issued us all with German, what they call gummi boot. It's the German rubber boots, which were moulded boots, which you used in the mine and were very tough. So I thought I'd retain those. What I took down with me, each little by little I took down food and supplies, hid them in certain places in the mine, along the mine shafts, so that when I came down with a canvas bag underneath my coat on the night I was going to go, I could pick up these things and use them as emergency rations. Now I had no papers, no maps, no compasses, so I thought, well, now I'm not going to get very far trying to get to the coast this way. So with the pole telling me a lot about what I could expect the other side of the border, if I could get across the border, I thought, right, I go east. And he told me that there was a large goodyard not far from where we were, if I could get out of the mine, where an awful lot of trains came there and loaded with coal, and most of those went east to the larger towns in Poland proper. So I thought, well, but he said, don't, whatever you do, try and cross the border in a coal train, because they are thoroughly searched. And if you think you're near a border, get off. Well, that was the information I kept in my mind. And indeed, on this particular day, when I, several people in the camp, the person in charge, the Sergeant Major, a fellow called James, he was an excellent fellow, and he helped me all he could. He knew who I was, I told him who I was. And he said, I was in Lambsdorff the other day, and I think there's a situation about they're looking for you. And I said, for what reason? And he said, well, he said, this is purely off the record, but I think that they're sitting on something. I think that your commission has come through, and he said, if it's known to the Germans, they're going to be looking for you to go to Stalag 3, which they would have been, because you have to go to Officer Camp. But they said, he said, Sergeant Major Sheriff, RSM Sheriff, and Lowe, two chaps were there, have asked the Geneva people to keep it as it is, and this is what's being done. So there was a very nice gesture from everybody concerned in administration to make sure that neither I nor the fellow that was standing in for me there was given away of an idea. I mean, it didn't matter about that side of things. I mean, nobody bothered about that sort of thing very much, and we had something going, and that was far more important than getting a ring on my sleeve, quite frankly. I couldn't have, you've done much with it there anyway. So, as a matter of fact, when I heard of Stalag 3, it would have meant that I'd have had to have put my name down for a possible escape attempt. Group Captain Massey was a senior British officer, I understand now, was a person who made very distinct rules on those occasions, rightly so, with all that number of people there and anxious to escape, linguists among them, and you had to go very much in your order of nomination. So I couldn't hope for much from that. I mean, it wasn't going to help me much in that quarter. The day I decided to go, I did all the things I suggested, went to the room, got my lamp, got all those things. I thoroughly dressed myself before going down, and I was unfortunate in one small respect. Just before our ship was due to go down, there was an enormous outcry, and one of the under-officers, who was a very excitable man and was very quick on the trigger finger, had found a lot of black market going on between the Poles and the soldiers, and he decided to come down himself on that shift to try and sort one or two people out. Because he was an excitable character, I wasn't very happy. He wasn't as if he was going to just go along and make a few inquiries of people. He travelled down in the cage with us. When I got down, he decided he'd have a thorough search of everybody and see if they were carrying black market material or whatever. And this was totally unpredicted. I mean, I couldn't possibly have foreseen this. Here I was, with my civilian clothes under my working clothes, going on shift. He was the sort of man that, if he'd have discovered that, would have become so excited that he would have probably have shot me. He was already rather excited about the amount he'd been bawled out for by the Lager Commandant about the black market was trading, it was going on underneath in the mines. And he started searching us. Searched the poles first, then he searched us. He found several things, but he found several things on the chap before he came to me. And I think I shall never know quite what made him just search my jacket as I had it on. I'd realised in the danger, I didn't expect to possibly get away with it, but I tightened my jacket by doing everything up to my throat, and I had just a blue jacket on, overall jacket, blue overall trousers. And he felt around, felt in all my pockets, felt there, you know, and didn't at any one stage have the gumption or the primity to open my jacket or to ask, you know, to ask any other questions. I suppose he felt that that was sufficient. I thanked God and everything else that there was, the powers that be, and he went on. There I was, sitting duck, really. However, went on to my shift, chastened, but thinking, well, whatever happens now, I've got to get away tonight, because doubtless he would be mounting a full search party at the pit head when we came up after the shift, and I would have, had I not gone, then I would have been complete. I mean, he would have, I'd have had to have put my clothes back after the shower and all that sort of thing. Lumps sticking up. Went on the shift. The chap said to me half an hour before the shift was due, well, okay, the charges are in. He did the charges. And we used to go and rest for 20 minutes after a charge. You go now. And I went off up to this. It took me 10 minutes to get to the end of the particular lift shaft, the shaft, not the lift shaft, the shaft, where the mining had finished. It was worked out. And to this particular lift shaft, which was going up, air shaft, which was going up to the surface. Now, it was an extremely long way up, and there were three stages of it. And each stage, as I climbed painfully up with my gear, I hadn't taken off my, obviously, my working gear, in case when I got to the surface I met somebody from the administration of German that was walking about and wanted to know what I was doing. As I got under each successive, I got onto small platforms and crossed to further large ways up. Some of the rungs were collapsing under my weight. And I realised they'd been rotten and probably were, had done for years. So there was no way back, so I pressed on. When I got to the top, there was a small cover to open, and I opened this to an enormous racket of noise, and I wondered what I let myself in for. I poked up and looked there, and in there were pans filching all the coal, called Rutschepans in German, segregating the types and nature of coal. And there were what seemed to be several dozens. It was in a sort of a shed, large shed, like a, perhaps a laundry, and all the dust was coming up from the coal pans, and so, all blackened characters with all the coal dust and sweat. However, I got up and I thought, well, these are obviously not Germans. They are probably workers from the East, because we knew they were working somewhere. We didn't have contact with them. And so I got up. As I got up, somebody came from behind me, been carrying bricks of coal, which they were putting together. And she said in, which I presume was Russian, something Tovarish, and I said, in German, sprechen Sie Deutsch. And she said, na, da, etwas, for little. And I said, you understand, I must get out, get out. She said, you know, who are you, Foerster? And I said, Englishman, you understand, English Kriegsgefangener. She said, and she understood English prisoner of war. And she said, well, I know where, but by this time we were talking. These women were, in fact, were Russian women. And we never had, I think Germans used to put such things as bromide in our tea, so I don't think we ever got the sexual urges we should have done in such circumstances. In any case, 60 in our day took most of the metal out of most people, and the rations weren't all that good. But these people were, I suppose, never seen men at all, or in that context, for months on end. And I had the most embarrassing situation where people were coming round and pawing me and everything and trying to get on with whatever they wanted to do, and I was trying to get on whatever I wanted to do. In the end, I had to, they were saying and making all sorts of gestures, and I said, well, look, I've got to get out. And she was saying to them, Angelsku, and, you know, he's an Englishman, he wants to go. He's been working down the mine. Eventually I got out. Went across the darkened quadrangle, as it were, skirted the wall, over the wall, dropped many feet, and then was away. And I hoped that by the time, you know, I had got, perhaps I'd had time, still had time to get clear, and made my way to the good station, where I could hear the trains clanking in the distance, and hoped that I would be fortunate in getting there, trying to keep to open country between little houses and things, and making generally the position by ear or hearing as I could, where there is a small glow in the sky with the train steaming up, and made my way. I suppose it must have been, 2 miles away, and if I fell once, I must have fallen 12 or 14 times into small pools that under them, small moonlight, looked like small roads, and they were pig iron trenches. So they just shone like asphalt, and as I stepped on, I went right through. So I was thoroughly soaked, of course, by the time I got to the station. Raised a few dogs, some odd houses barking, but otherwise hadn't been checked at all. And got into the sidings there, and didn't have a chance. There was a train making up steam. Didn't have a chance to look at anything resembling a destination. And got over, swung up onto the coal. The coal was tightly packed at the bottom, at the top. Huge carriages. Knew by the way the rails were going, they were pointing to the east. But of course I had no means of knowing whether they were going to continue that way at all. Just had to take a chance. It was completely hit and miss, really. This is where good fortune, which you have to have in all these things, however well planned it is, came again into reckoning, and I got onto a train which was in fact going east, directly east. I burrowed down into the coal, made a place for myself, and the weather was freezing. It was something like about, I would imagine, 20 below, and my clothes were beginning to freeze on me, but I snuggled down in the coal, and I was tired, and excitement was pumping through me, fever pitch. And I then waited to see what would happen farther down the line. Having decided that to remain as warm as possible, it was best to snuggle down as far as I could in the truck's concern and get away from the metal sides, I did this by burrowing quite hard. What I didn't quite realise was that although I had sufficient direction from the stars to give me a very good idea without compass of which direction I was travelling, which was almost due east, I remember. Of course, I had no idea of distances, and sat for some time musing about how I could possibly determine length of time taken to go certain distances, when everything obviously became too much and I fell asleep. Frozen with cold and absolutely abject at the fact that I might have overslept and be far either A, past my destination, or B, carried on towards the border, which I'd been warned very definitely not to approach in that way. I woke up with a great start and pushed around and got myself head and shoulders out when the carriages began to pull up. The engine was braking, and looking past the engine into the foreground, I could see a very large concentration of lights shining down onto the rails, which was obviously a method by which they were putting trucks under that were going to stay for the night near the border. It was a concentrated zone. There were several trains standing there already with their lights right over the trucks and the engines, and I could see figures moving about quite close to them. So I assumed this was some form of, not search exactly, but examination. And I managed, as the train began to slow, I got out.